Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's a privilege, as always, to welcome back John Rappaport for his quarterly report. I've mooched in on it, in fact, because I've gotten many questions from subscribers over the last couple months about mind control. We've done an introduction to mind control. You can find it in the archives, but I realized there was a need to have a new round of discussion about mind control and related to current events. And I realized there's nobody better to help me do it than John Rappaport. So, John, welcome to the Soleria Report.
Always great to be here, Catherine. Thank you.
Okay, so mind control, what is it? I'm going to turn that one to you.
Okay. Well, as the phrase suggests, this is a person having ideas, thoughts, impulses that are truly not his or her own. They're coming from somewhere else. It also means that large sections of perception and reality are obliterated. They're not even on the map. So, for example, we talk about the light spectrum and how there is a visible part of it and an invisible to the naked eye part of it. So that's a good metaphor for this aspect of mind control. The person is not even aware that there's a whole vast territory out there which he could see but doesn't. So I would say that that's a good starting point for saying, you know, what mind control is. It is synthetic, artificial perception, as opposed to the person's own authentic perception and thought.
Right, and the thing I find interesting about this topic is there are so many different ways that our minds can be influenced or controlled, and it is relatively easy, unless you understand that those techniques exist, and that a great deal of time and money is spent developing them and using them, it's very difficult to understand this topic. So when we talk about mind control, when I talk about mind control, I'm talking not just about very concrete, direct ways of one person, you know, for example, hypnotizing another person. So that's a very one-on-one, but we're talking about different techniques of group influence and control. So it goes all the way from propaganda or simply, you know, conditioning by your society to encourage you to believe certain things or adopt certain notions, or simply tricking you with education that lies to you. So general kinds of communal mind control to, you know, so from very specific to communal to mass techniques like entrainment technology. So there are many different kinds of mind control and many different gradations, some of which people don't think of mind control, they think of as propaganda. And I think that the tricky thing about the subject is building sort of a taxonomy of the different kinds of mind control, because there are many. And you go to, I went to an Ivy League university, and you come out with a picture of history that I would describe as mind control.
I was just going to say that. I was just going to add history to the mix. I also went to a little Ivy League college, and I had a similar experience. I mean, you come out believing, well, you know, I've got the best information here. I mean, how could it not be the best? These are the premier teachers, historians, I've read the right books, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, later on you read something and you realize my mind has been completely hijacked. I have this idea of what took place in Europe, let's say, in the 1930s and 40s. That's totally missing many of the key facts, which if I understood, I would see things in an entirely different way. And so people, and I used to be one of them, denigrated the whole idea of history. You know, God, do we have to read this stuff, et cetera, et cetera. but later came to see, well, this is a fantastic way of exerting mind control on people, because people believe that the past shapes the present, and you give them a picture of the past and you say, this is what happened. And they say, oh, I see. Well, okay. So the present now makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah.
Right.
Mind control past creates the mind controlled
present. Yeah. So
it certainly would make a lot of sense.
Well, it's funny. I went back in the 90s. I went back and studied the whole history of my family as I was trying to understand what was really happening in the economy. And what I realized is, oh, the tapeworm's been rolling my family for centuries. You know, but we never see it. We never see it as the harvesting process that it is, because we haven't really gone back and learned our real history. And it's very interesting. If you go back and you see the process by which your family and your community has been harvested, you see ways of building the immune system you need to defeat it. But of course, that means you need to break the mind control. And at this point, there's so many different interests trying to mind control you. It's quite a challenge. Well, I wanted
entire society these days, because of public relations, which is yet another form of mind control,
right,
is really a mind control obsessed society. People
right.
are paid enormous amounts of money to decide what can we say and how can we say it so that people will buy it. It doesn't matter what we're selling. It only matters that we succeed in selling it. Therefore, we can say anything in order to, you know, have that effect on the other end. And I don't know, you know, somebody should do a study on how much money is actually being sucked up in the economy for people whose total jobs are really to do public relations in this way. It's just enormous. There are so many people who go to work every day and their job is to figure out, how do I say something so that someone else is going to buy it without thinking about it?
Right. So they're creating an official reality, and that official reality is a reality that allows the governance in the system to work in a certain way, including the financial harvesting. See, I could never believe that the mind control was as serious and as intentional and as significant as it is until I could understand financially why anyone would spend that much money getting people to buy into an official reality. And once I sort of unpacked the economics of why this is a much more efficient slavery system than slavery, what I realized is, oh, you know, this makes a lot of sense. And so I agree, it's an extraordinary amount of time and money that goes into sort of doing those things. Well, let's go back in history, because I think the other thing that really made me struggle to understand a lot of this stuff is I didn't understand how far back it goes. And one of my favorite books to introduce people who don't know about mind control but are interested is Carla Emery's book, Secret, Don't Tell. I don't know if you've read it, John.
No, I haven't.
You seen that? But one of the things it does is it goes back through history to the Templars going to the Middle East and going on the Crusades and bringing back the technology that the assassins had developed to build, you know, basically assassins, the world's perfect hitman, being one who can't remember that he did the hit. She calls it criminal hypnosis, and she traces it throughout history. And you see that this is something that's been going on, you know, particularly through the secret societies for a lot longer than I think people imagine. This is not just a new phenomena. And she takes it, of course, through the development, you know, the big money went into this research, certainly the Nazis did. And then what you see is that with the creation of the National Security State, the secret societies literally got a hold of infinite financing through the government mechanism to finance this kind of stuff. And so you see an institutionalization, an increase of money into research, and then this explosive development of mind control on a much grander scale than anybody in the Middle Ages could have ever dreamed.
The science of Coercion is another. I think that's a very interesting book. Christopher Simpson. And this is about psychological warfare operatives coming out of World War II, 1945, having spent the entire war period trying to influence the public mind and people, not only in the United States, you know, about the war, about how they should view the enemy, so on and so forth. Got lots of stories about that. And so when these people emerged from World War II, their backers and handlers and funders created a whole new academic discipline for them called mass communications research, which is really just a pseudo kind of science. I mean, it isn't like physics or biology, but an academic discipline that would allow these people to continue on doing what they were doing, have money, grants, teaching positions, et cetera, so that they could now do exactly what they were doing in the wartime on the populace of the United States, to turn them into androids as far as their view of the rest of the world, how they should view people, stereotypes, how do you implant stereotypes of other people in people's minds.
Right.
This became an enormous enterprise, and it still is. It's done nothing but expand since then.
I wanted to go through, because I find books and movies in particular, because it's, you know, if you look at the time it takes to read some of these really good books, it's more time consuming. But I wanted to go through some of the best books and movies just to help people who want to explore this topic. So let's start with books. So you described Simpson's book. I described Emery. Another one I would add is 1996. Have you ever read that, John?
No.
By Gloria Naylor. Gloria Naylor was a very famous novelist. She wrote The Brewster of Women, The Women of Brewster Place, a marvelous book that got picked up by Oprah Winfrey, made a movie out of it. And she was a writer about sort of women in communities, very intimate stuff, not political at all, and got targeted in 1996 by covert operations. That was my guess from reading her story, is that they were prototyping mind control. You had a memorandum of understanding in the early 90s between the Department of Justice and the Department of Defense. And I think for application of, quote, non-lethal weapons in domestic situations. And I think a process began where there was a lot of prototyping on American citizens of this kind of technology. And I got into it because I was dealing with all sorts of bizarre covert operations during the litigation. Anyway, so I did a lot of research trying to figure out what was happening to us and why. Anyway, Naylor finally wrote a book about it, and it was a very courageous act. It's called 1996. She calls it a conflagration, something like that. I can't pronounce it, but where you turn your experience into sort of a combination, both biography and fiction, so that it helps the reader understand what was happening to you. And she describes all the different technology that can literally put thoughts into your head and sort of manipulate your mind in very sort of blunt ways. And I should say the electromagnetic weaponry and sort of invasive digital systems now gives you literally the ability to create machines that can read minds and insert sort of information into it. Anyway, but she describes what it's like to be targeted by this stuff. And it's a short book. It's an easy read. And I think she's a very credible person. I believe absolutely it happened to her for reasons we won't go into now. But it gives you a sense of what it's like to be on the other side of this. So that's the Carla Emery and the Gloria Naylor book, I would add. And I agree with you. Simpson's book is excellent and goes into the, you know, many of the propaganda aspects of mind control. Any other books you want to mention?
Well, certainly Search for the Manchurian Candidate, John Marks,
right,
I interviewed some years ago. He was one of the key figures who broke open the fact that CIA had a program called MKUltra, a wide-ranging mind control program that, it's hard to put dates on this, but let's say 1953, 1962, which was trauma-based mind control, drugs, hypnosis, disorientation, with the whole idea of being able to create a person who was, you know, completely under your control. Much to be read about that. There are two other very good books, one called The Mind Manipulators by Alan Shefflin, and then Walter Bauart's famous book, Operation Mind Control.
Yeah, that's really good.
So what John Marks told me was that through Freedom of Information Act requests, many on his part, finally, as a kind of an insult, I guess you could say, or CIA sent him 10 boxes of financial information that seemed to be relevant to MKUltra, thinking that he would never be able to do anything with this material. But in fact, because he was a very smart guy, he was able to suss out through the money where some of these projects were being launched and what they were doing. And this led him to being able to interview certain people and put together the outlines of this whole program, which he described in the book, Search for the Manchurian Candidate. So when I interviewed him, he said to me, in 1962, supposedly when the program ended, it was really just shifted over to another department of the CIA called ORD, Office of Research and Development, which in fact he discovered. He made more FOIA requests for information, and he was finally told by somebody, we have over 100 boxes of information on this. You're never going to see any of it. It's never going to see the light of day. You can make as many requests as you want to, and you're never going to find out anything about it. So this is the end of the story.
Right.
So that's an intriguing book. And, of course, then we have the movies done a couple of times, The Manchurian Candidate, which I think are very useful movies, especially the first one with Frank Sinatra, that people can see, you know, the kind of very blunt trauma type of mind control inflicted on people through hypnosis and torture and disorienting drugs.
Now, if you watch the first Manchurian Candidate, then the second, and you sort of bring down to the school shootings, which we'll get in later, my understanding is the speed and technology to create a mind-controlled, you know, to take a child and turn them into somebody who could pick up a gun and shoot another human being. In other words, if you look at the, say, in the 50s when they had started MKUltra, say it took 100 to 500 hours, now you're talking about something that can be done in a very short period of time, relatively.
Certainly the sophistication has, you know, expanded tremendously. It's gotten into the electromagnetic induction of mind control as opposed to just simply pounding on somebody's head with, you know, gigantic
doses
of LSD and all that kind of thing.
Right. So, and, you know, one of my deep prejudices, I believe that some of the money that the CIA was using for MKUltra was financing some of the Nazis who they had brought over, who's had very, you know, had invested a lot in developing this technology during the war. So there was a real continuum thread from the Nazis through to the national security state. But so, you know, we've spent 60 or 100 years, if you count the Nazis, we spent 100 years trying to get really sophisticated at this stuff and do it, you know, at low cost on broad scale. Let me mention a couple movies. If you go back to the old ones, did you ever see Telephone with Charles Bronson?
A long time ago. My memory is a little spotty on that movie.
That one, you know, like the first Manchurian candidate, that's an early mind control, and I think that's pretty useful. Another one I love is Long Kiss Goodnight, because that what that does is that gives the fact pattern of the child of a military or intelligence officer who's sort of indoctrinated into this stuff. You know, it's not. There's a thought that this only happens arbitrarily to the enemy, or that only happens to somebody who lives in the margins of society. And I think, you know, what we have to contemplate is whether or not we're watching presidents, you know, who literally have gone through this. And so the Long Kiss Goodnight kind of gives you that fact pattern. Another one I love is The Forgotten with Julianna Moore. Have you ever seen that one?
No.
That's about a mother who is part of a group whose the children in it's a group of parents. The children are taken off to a camp and disappear, never come back. And the question is, can they get the parents to forget that they ever had children? It's
Wow.
quite it's quite interesting. Then of course, Total Recall with Arnold Schwarzenegger, with the use of, you know, memory. Wiping people's memory out.
Great movie.
Yeah.
I thought it was.
And of course I had to mention They Live.
Yeah.
Now, They Live has come up many times in the last 2 months. I kind of wonder why. But I keep telling people, you know, that you and I did a wonderful Solari report on the best 10 movies to kind of explain reality, and the way we came at it was you were gonna pick five, I was gonna pick five, and then we showed up with our two lists, and the only one we had both chosen, the only movie that was on both lists was They Live. So why don't you describe They Live?
Billboards everywhere, subliminal perception, glasses that are found in a dumpster that allow people who wear the glasses to actually see reality behind reality, and that we have been invaded and taken over by some, you know, alien species that is bent on complete control through television broadcasting. And, you know, the billboards, when you actually read what's behind the signs, you know, say things like, you know, obey, procreate, you know, the sort of basic commands of modern society. And the two heroes who go up against this and finally, you know, win out in this kind of questionable solution to the whole thing. But it's tremendously raw. It's very real. It's right in your face. It was a, you know, a Roger Corman low budget movie, so there's no fooling around. You get the violence, you get the courage, you get the horror of discovering that there are people walking around who are seemingly normal, but are actually, when you can view them through these glasses, aliens who are taking over, in the process of taking over. A fantastic kind of scenario. You know, you said something a minute ago that I need to comment on, the talent camps. These are real. You talked about the Julianne Moore movie. So we have these talent camps around the country that take young kids for the summer and develop their abilities. And one of these talent camps, the name escapes me at the moment, in the Southeast, hosted, for example, Mark Zuckerberg, Lady Gaga, Sergey Brin, one of the co-founders of Google, when they were kids. And we're talking about talent spotting at a very young age. And who knows what kind of indoctrination took place at these camps with these kids, but certainly they were marked and spotted for later funding so that their visions about what they wanted to create in society would be amply bankrolled and could actually, you know, come about. So this is quite real.
Right. That kind of targeting, you know, it's one of the reasons that the testing has increased dramatically in schools. The amount of money spent on sort of targeting, identifying talent, using that talent and channeling it in various ways is enormous. So if you look at who leads the society, they, you know, they invest a lot in sort of developing, organizing, and managing human capital in a way that is invisible to most people. So, and if you try and explain that that's the way it works, you know, they kind of can't fathom that it really does, but it's true. Let me see if there are any other. Zoolander was another one I wanted to mention. Zoolander is about sort of use of mind control in the modeling world. And, you know, it's a little bit more of a comedy than some of the others. What's interesting, though, is if you sit down and you watch all of these different movies, what you realize is, you know, Hollywood is telling us everything about this. It's not like this is a big secret.
Absolutely. And I think that one of the underlying factors here in societal mind control is to create a society that really operates on basic pleasure-pain modalities. In other words, this becomes, for the average person, the ceiling on what they see as being possible in life. You can either have pain or you can have pleasure. And by pleasure is meant, you know, lowest common denominators of pleasure, food,
right,
sex, et cetera, glamour, and so on. Thought, mind, thinking, actual thinking is, you know, just off the boards entirely. That has nothing to do with anything as far as this formula is concerned. In other words, to reduce the entire society down to very short attention span, very little thinking, and all about seeking pleasure over pain.
Right.
Oh, I can get pleasure here. So this is an androidal concept to me. This is like creating a sort of science fiction society for real, where the bulk of the population eventually comes over to the, you know, very hard belief that there are really only two choices in life, and no matter what I have to do, I'm going to opt for the pleasure angle and not think about anything else.
Sort of like Curtis Mayfield's song. He says, sometimes it feels like there's one way in and no way out.
Exactly.
So I just have to tell you a story, which to me underscores what we're talking about. I was driving down the highway in the early 2000s, and I had a wonderful college roommate from the University of Pennsylvania whose basic interest in reading was People magazine and romantic novels. And I drive down the highway, and my cell phone rings, and I pick up the phone, and she says, "Fitz," she said, "what, everything you're saying about the mortgage fraud must be true." I said, "Pray tell, why is that?" And she said, "Oh, well, Tony Soprano, the Soprano TV show, is doing a series on HUD fraud, and it's all the stuff you've been saying. So now I realize it's true." And I said, "So wait a minute. If a fictional TV show shows it as being true, then it's true. Whereas I, as the former Assistant Secretary of Housing and the former lead financial advisor to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, if I say it's true, it's not true until I'm affirmed by a fictional TV show." And she said, "Yes, that's right." And what she meant by that was that in America, you know, you had to live within the official reality. And until the TV could affirm that it was acceptable to believe this, it was a waste of your time and inconvenient to believe it. And whether it was true or not was irrelevant. So, which is why I say in America, fact is fiction and fiction is fact. But we're all very busy people. And if something is, you know, not permitted in the official reality, what we know is it's going to be inconvenient or time consuming to adopt that or talk about that in public because it's not acceptable. I have a very dear friend who's always saying, you know, why don't people understand? And I say, they do understand, because if you remember that scene in They Live, the glasses allow you to see what's really going on. But no one wants the glasses because they really don't want to see what's going on, because they're busy, they're tired, and it's awfully inconvenient to put on the glasses and take a look at what's really going on.
An inconvenient truth.
Okay, so let's just talk about the finances of this, because, and when we get into finances, I do want to introduce the concept. While this stuff has been going on for centuries, there's no doubt about it that wireless technology, digital technology, allow much greater invasiveness. So we're seeing cell towers all over the country. And I have to tell you, based on doing as much traveling as I do and relating the towers to phone service, whatever the cell tower is about, they're not just about phone service. So we have a cell tower system that's, you know, sending signals out. We now have smart meters on the home. We have people walking around with handheld devices, which carry enormous amounts of entrainment. You know, so we're talking about systems that are now much, much more invasive in terms of, you know, our physicality. I spend a lot of time trying to avoid them. And what I've learned is that at this point in America, it's almost impossible. So we now have these very invasive systems, and there are also very invisible systems. Let's talk about financial profit, because when you have the kind of invasive collection of information, as Edward Snowden has now described, and you can use that information for management, it's very easy now to step back and envision the fact that a lot of this mind control has to do with organizing society, controlling society, but harvesting it financially. Would you say that that's true?
Absolutely. I mean, but I want to hear more from you about the finances, because it's just clear to me, you know, in general, that we're seeing an embrace between technology, corporations, government, in what you're saying here, because all of this digital technology feeds back to us, you know, profiling, et cetera, the ads that follow you around on the internet wherever you go is just a sort of a light example of this, because somebody's profiling you and you went to a site, and now all of a sudden, no matter where you go for a couple of weeks, you see these ads, you know, which I used to think everybody was seeing, you know, until I realized,
Well, I came to realize that, you know, I was doing all this work in the 90s with relational databases, and I knew what I was building. We were building relational databases that would allow us to look at all the money in the economy by place and relate it to what was in the publicly traded markets. And then when I moved down to Tennessee, what I realized was, if you look at how different sort of people were being targeted, both, you know, with illegal products and legal products. You know, somebody would lose their job. The next day, Chase would be there with a 30% interest rate credit card, and the local drug dealer would be there with drugs. And what you could tell is everybody was being identified and harvested. In other words, how many ways can we make money from this person doing what, blah, 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 blah. I'll never forget when I sat down and looked at the student loan system and how it had been adapted or re-engineered during the 90s. They had figured out how to create a system where you could make more money from people failing than succeeding. It was quite extraordinary. So you're talking about systems that can identify and track everybody and everything, all their financial transactions, all the time, using artificial intelligence. I had one great ally say to me after the Snowden revelations came out and said, oh, well, you know, they only have the manpower at most to track 25,000 people. I said, no, with machines and artificial intelligence, they can track 300 million people all the time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one movie I always recommend to people is Enemy of the State, because that shows you where they were, you know, many years ago in terms of tracking and managing and sort of targeting your financial stuff. So, you know, I've been a target of a team like the team described in the Enemy of the State movie. And I can tell you, or, you know, you can watch the teams in the Bourne Identity and how they kind of track and target people and the data they have available. And it's quite amazing to be on the other side of that. But it's all very, very real. But here's what I will say. If you look at the financial system, John, the amount of money that's being sucked out, you know, and disappearing is extraordinary. What I would say is the financial wealth currently is 1% of what it could be if we were free to just optimize total wealth and align the financial system with the environmental system. And so the amount that is sub-optimized here on purpose is extraordinary, because control, you know, and one of the reasons they try and control this way, as I said, if you can create slaves who don't know they're slaves, that's much more profitable than if they know. If somebody knows they're a slave, they stop working. So, or, you know, they don't work with the same sort of enthusiastic spirit. So this has been, you know, mind control has been an extraordinarily profitable technology. If you look at running the system the way we run it, so I always use the example of $4 trillion disappearing from the federal government. How do you get a group of people to help steal $4 trillion without wanting a piece of the action? You know, mind control and control files is the way you do it. If you can have someone commit a murder and not remember that they did it, that is much more economically that's much more economic than having to, you know, having somebody who can remember in terms of managing a big operation that includes assassinations. So we're talking about technology that's very economic, but let's take it a step further. If you look at the way our financial system works, all of our financial markets and our financial leverage depend on people trusting the system. And so you invest a great deal of money to create the official reality that the rule of law is really real. And I think if there's any danger in the economy right now, it's that myth is breaking down. You know, people are no longer, you know, they don't have the same trust in the system. And one of the things you see the leadership grappling about is that's not good. You know, that's not good if people don't believe, because then the liquidity in the system freezes up and people stop investing and building.
And then the constant consumer economy, you know, to me is always on the edge of a cliff, because if large numbers of people tomorrow said, you know, I have enough, I don't need any more.
Mm-hmm.
I got a place to live, I got a car, I got a television set, I got a computer, I got a cell phone, I've got clothes, okay, food. Well, you know, what are you going to give me that I don't have already that's not just an updated version of what I've already got? And so there's this sort of terror at the heart of the whole system, which is, we have to exert enough mind control so that enough people think that they have to keep on buying endlessly, otherwise the whole system collapses, which to me is yet another indicator that, you know, something is terribly wrong here, because,
right,
you know, it just doesn't work. I mean, do you really have to buy a car every year or lease a new car every year? And what titanic amount of propaganda and subliminal this and that are necessary in order to get a person to believe that and to actually go out and spend the money that they may or may not have just so that it's a 2015 car rather than 14 car? I mean, from that aspect alone, the amount of money necessary to make people do that, you know, could be equivalent to the amount of money that they're actually spending to do it. It's just, it's absurd.
I see the most powerful force being the need or making sure that people crave being in the system.
Right.
So if you look at real solutions, John, one of the most important solutions is that in a system where peace makes more money than war, it's because the people who are engaging in warfare, whether it's overt or covert, are seen as dirty players and they're shunned. So if I'm, if I'm engineering a tsunami and making money from it, then I'm identified as a creep. And no matter how much money I have, the human race shuns me. So the system has a healthy feedback loop. And so the key to making a system like this work is you need people to, you need people to do evil things for you and then be honored and admired, because money isn't enough. You need admiration. And so you want to get the most, the people engineering the evil for you to be, sort of identified as fashionable. And you want everybody to hunger to be in with the in crowd. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's critical to evil winning. So we see now the Bushes ready to get Jeb Bush in the White House. And so we now have the New York Times doing a big piece on George W. Bush's paintings of world leaders, and they're artistic and it's cultural and it's sort of soft and neatsy keen. And we have the New York Magazine writing an article called The Good Bush. You know, too bad about George W. His father was really the good guy. He's a nice patrician wasp. It's all good. Now, it's real funny because you see the comments and it looks like that social media event at J.P. Morgan Chase with commenters just going wild. You can literally see them foaming in the mouth through the internet, and they're listing all the books that will tell you the truth on Poppy Bush, and, it's all pouring out. But you see this effort to make these people to be admired. And so to me, one of the most important ways to break through the mind control is to see if we can't reduce that trance of, I'll never forget when I sort of left the status quo and moved out into the wilderness, I found so many writers and researchers who were just trying to get back into the New York Times. And I kept saying, why are you doing that? It's a complete waste of your time. there's nothing authentic going on there. You've got to come out here and build something authentic. And one of the reasons I was so, when I found you, I said, now this guy gets it. You weren't trying to get in the New York Times. You were trying to publish the truth, and you were totally clear there was no point in talking to them.
I was trying to destroy the New York Times.
Ah. But anyway, so the question is, can we build authentic pathways without getting, cycled back into, the modified hangout within the official reality? I don't know, but I think, I think part of the mind control is to always give somebody an easy way back into the trap.
You bet. Yeah, sure. You had 16 credit cards, and you accumulated the following amount of debt, which is totally insupportable, and you're a criminal, and this, that, and the other thing, and we hound you, and eventually it all somehow works out or goes away, and then all of a sudden, hey, we'd love to have you. Here's a card you can get right now. And now... but one of the things, to go back to what you said, you're in or you're out. This is sort of the formula that they want to pose. Do you feel like you're in or do you feel like you're out? If you feel like you're out, there's something wrong with you, nobody likes you, you're going to be a social pariah, so you got to get back in. And here's obviously how you get back in. And now you're in and everything's okay. You don't have to think about anything. To me, one of the bottom line solutions or answers to all of what we're talking about here is that thoughtful people say to themselves, what is my reality? And maybe they, just to suggest a really radical idea, suppose you actually took a piece of paper or you opened up a file and you began to write about that, the answers to that question. Not three words or less, but, an ongoing kind of project. What's my reality? And aligned with that is, what reality do I want? because one of the things that's left out of most discussions about mind control is that a person can recognize the difference between his own thoughts and those thoughts that are being put into his consciousness. And one of the best ways to do that is to decide and find out what your own thoughts are, to become more familiar
right.
with your own ideas, your own thoughts, your own principles, so that you can differentiate those from the mind control that is being implemented throughout society. And this, to me, is a great starting point for that.
The other thing I think is to when you have ideas, when you have thoughts, is to give them time and to work with others on them. You know, I find collaboration with certain kinds of people. I have a much stronger mind if I'm collaborating with other people who have very strong minds, and I work with them to test ideas, to vet information. So there are all different ways of vetting things, and it requires a lot of patience. It requires saying, I don't know, and being willing to not know, because the greatest way you trap people in mind control is they want certainty. And you give them a solution, you give them an answer, you give them an idea that's a little bit too easy. And they're not willing to sit there in the wilderness and say, I don't know. I just wanted to bring up a couple things, John, because one of the things that inspired us doing this conversation today was I had a wonderful subscriber email and say, you know, I don't see a way that what is going on could be going on unless all of our leaders are mind controlled. And, you know, or a lot of them are mind controlled. And I'll never forget watching Janet Reno explain what had happened at Waco. And everything she was saying was a complete lie. It was just factually not correct. But when she said it with such conviction. If I hadn't known the facts and seen hard evidence and talked to people who absolutely had the story, you know, I was amazed. And so you wonder, is this woman mind controlled or is she just the world's best liar? And one of the things I've seen, because, you know, in working in government, you see it, is you have bred a generation of people who now believe, you know, that there are multiple personalities. There are multiple worlds. So there's the real world, and then there's the official reality. And they've spent their whole life being trained in presenting an official reality that's different than reality. And they believe that's absolutely okay. So last night I just watched the documentary in Rumsfeld called The Known Unknown, or The Unknown Known. I forget which one it is. And you interview this guy who sounds like he's absolutely mad as a hatter. And one of the reasons it sounds that way is because he's trying to balance between reality and the official reality, and he can't talk to you about reality. It didn't occur to him that he ever would. Do you know what I mean? Because that's just not done. And therefore, he makes no sense whatsoever. But, you know, but he feels perfectly confident in doing that because he's just spent his entire lifetime doing that. So we have a multiple personality disorder world, and we have a whole generation of leadership who's been trained to function that way. And they really don't know that there's any other way. And I think it's hard for the average person to realize that it's that bad. But in fact, it is that bad. If you said to me, you know, that there are 2 million people in America who've had either been chipped or had direct mind control, I'd say that's possible.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, I've had some experience with this myself in different venues, journalism, for example, medical. The people, official reality means to me, you do and say whatever you need to so that the ends, the objectives that you're after are accomplished, you know, ends justify
right.
the means. And when this is driven home heavily enough to people in certain positions, as you say, they accept it as a way of life. They accept that it can't be any other way. We know that what we're striving for is good, whatever that is, whatever they think that is, you know, such as populations have to be controlled, for example, you know, otherwise, oh, you know. Therefore, any lie that we tell, anything that we say or do that is in support of that is admirable and necessary. And conversely, anything that we might say that would blow a hole in that whole picture, that would be criminal. That would be something that we should be punished for, because that would be horrible. So we'll never do that unless we slip up. And that's basically the attitude. And
right.
Once that's implanted deeply enough, then, you know, these people wake up lying in the morning. They just get out of bed and start lying. And they go to bed at night feeling like, you know, they've done the right thing, and that's it. One of the things that I found both amusing and somewhat distressing is in this whole Snowden affair, I wrote a couple of articles questioning, let's say, some of the background story that's been floated about Snowden and so forth. Won't go into details, but got lots of response to that. And then I wrote a piece saying, let's be clear about this. People in the intelligence world, they lie all the time.
Right.
That's what they're supposed to do.
Right. That's their business. They're paid to lie.
That's what we're in the business for. And when you get a job with one of these agencies, that's a serious job. I mean, you're expected, you know, it's understood that that's what you're going to do all the time.
Well, I look back over the last 10 years, and one of the reasons I've said things are going to slow burn, they're not going to collapse, is if you look at the mechanisms in place to control, they're much greater than people know. And I think, I was very touched by the news yesterday that the chairman of a big Dutch bank had, the news report said, committed suicide and killed his daughter and wife. Now, who knows what the truth of that is? I'm assuming it was an assassination. I don't know that. It could have been mind controlled. I mean, the guy could have been mind controlled and then turned around and done that. But you watch a situation like that, and I think most people are terrified by it, and it makes them want to toe the line even more. So to me, the ultimate mind control, John, is when the people running things have the power to kill with impunity, do it invisibly, get away with it, you know, and everybody's watching it and saying, the last thing I want to do is bring that down on my family. And so we're watching, you know, there is a war of terror, but I think a lot of it involves the mind control programming. A couple other thoughts. How do we, I would say it this way. To me, there's an incredible benefit of facing and understanding that all this technology exists in our society. And that is, I think, you cannot protect yourself from something unless you can see it. And although it's quite a gruesome process to learn and understand it and see it, when you do, things start to make a lot more sense. So, you know, situations like the school shootings, which seem completely unfathomable. You just can't fathom what really happened. Once you understand mind control and the fact that these things can be engineered as ops, and mind control can be involved in a variety of ways, then those, you know, the events start to make a lot more sense. Would you say that's the case?
Absolutely. No question about it. I think maybe the biggest benefit of understanding, say, the school shootings and so on, and other of these ops and the overall mind control that goes on, is then you can say, well, I'm not in, I'm out. And then you can define for yourself what out means, not as a withdrawal or a negative, but as a positive.
Right.
What does it mean to be out? What am I going to do now that I'm out? Now that I can see enough to know that I'm not part of any of that, I don't want any of that. I have my own reality. I'm out. To me, that's a key starting point for any person, to be able to know that and say that and mean it, because that's kind of the make-break thing. You know, you're in or you're out, you know, as the mom says, right? You're in or you're out. Are you in or are you out? That's the question. And if you say, I'm out, then the whole world opens up.
Right.
Another world of possibility opens up, because now you're steering the ship, your ship. Now, what do you...
You know, maybe the ultimate mind control movie is The Truman Show, because that's exactly what happens.
Exactly.
You know, the protagonist doesn't realize he's in a basically a reality TV show, and finally he gets up and he says, okay, I'm walking off the set. Here we go. I just wanted, before we close, I just wanted to mention one of my favorite sort of moments on this topic. You and I did a great Salieri report called The Matrix Revealed when you published your new collection of interviews. Thank you again for doing that. And we talked about the Ellis Medavoy interviews, which are some of my favorite of your interviews. And we talked about this sort of, he's a retired PR executive explaining through you and through your interviews how, you know, our reality was created and manipulated. And if you listen to his description of what he did and who he did it, my guess is he worked for the executive committee, the Council on Foreign Relations is my guess, but it was a group like that. Anyway, but I had a wonderful subscriber email in and said, oh my God, I've taken all these new age courses about how you can invent your world and, you know, they never went anywhere. And then I listened to you guys talk about how these guys construct my reality for me. And I realized, wait a minute, if they can construct my reality for me, I can construct my reality for me. And she said, you know, I finally get it. I really can create my own world, because now I see how my world is being created for me. And to me, that is the greatest power of taking the time to read through and learn all this gruesome stuff about how this stuff works, because suddenly you realize, wait a minute, if all these guys can create my reality, I can too. You know, so I can learn my real history. I can see my real present. I can, you know, I can't stop all this stuff from going down. It's way, you know, this is an overwhelming amount of mind control going on. But what I can do is I can just leave. I can say, okay, I'm off the reality TV set. I'm going to try and live an authentic life. And I'll tell you something. When I started to do it, John, you know, it was hard. And I found you and I found some other great people who, you know, helped me tremendously. I mean, I got the benefit of your many decades of work. So we're all sort of standing on the shoulders of other people who've, you know, built the authentic pathways. Anyway, so I start doing the Salieri report, and every week I'm covering financial stuff. And then a couple years ago, I was in an airport in Texas, and one of the top financial shows was on, and I was getting something to eat. You know, I don't own a TV, so I never watch the stuff. And I realized this guy was using all my material. He was using whole sentences from my stuff. He was using expressions. Well, it's like Warren Buffett is now using the tapeworm, you know. And I thought, wait a minute, you know, I've gone from building an authentic pathway to all these guys stealing it back for the official reality. So now I'm inventing, you know, I guess I get to invent the world. I just don't get paid for it. Anyway, you know, there is a way to do it, but I would really encourage everyone listening to this today to take the time to watch these movies, read these books, learn about this stuff, because you will be in a much stronger position to understand and navigate our society if you know it exists. And frankly, that's step one to building your immune system. Know it exists and know we're all being targeted with it. And I think it can make a difference. So, John, before we close, maybe if you could just say a few more words about where to begin. You've listened to this. You're ready to read the books and movies. What else do you do?
What I would add is, and I can you know, base this on personal experience. Don't be afraid of the mind control society, because that keeps you from learning more and more about what it is. It's better to learn more and more about what it is, because the fear will lessen and go away the more you know. It's just the way things work. Whereas if you're constantly saying, well, that's just too horrible to contemplate, then you're always in retreat. You're always backing into a corner. You're always trying to not know about things. I don't want to hear about that and stuff. And then that state of being is just not a good place to be. It's not good for your health. It's not good for your future. It's not good for seeing what it is that you really want. It's not good for collaborating with other people who see the truth. Don't worry about being afraid of the mind control society. It's much better to dig in and learn all about it, because the more you learn about it, then the stronger you'll feel, the less fearful you actually will be, and then your position of being out rather than in will be extremely more powerful. And then right. Finding other people like that, that you can work with and collaborate with, will build a sensational future for you.
Yeah, that everybody who withdraws from the mind control, you know, we shift the group mind, and then it becomes something. I just have to close with this story. My favorite part in the Ellis Medavoy interviews is when you get frustrated with him and blow up and say, well, if we're so stupid and you guys are so smart, why are you even talking to me? And he explains the fact that they could never quite get control, that there was this group intelligence that always somehow eluded them. It's what I call the divine intelligence. And I'll never forget walking, getting up as with your interview in my hand, walking around the house going, I knew it. And it's the other story is this mutual friend we have, where I'd introduced him to a group of energetic healers up in Montana, and he didn't understand what that was. But I was really talking about how we can communicate and resonate, you know, spiritually with each other. And he turned to me and he said, wait a minute. If what you're telling me is right, he said, the bad guys can't win. We can win. I said, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, so John, thank you so much for doing this with me. I think it helps the subscribers. If you want to understand the financial system, I think this is a topic that helps enormously. And as you carry along your little cell phone and carry that entrainment with you, I think it pays to understand the power of both what you've got in your pocket, but the power of our mind to deal with it. So, John, you have a wonderful day.
You too, Catherine. Thanks again. It's always great to be with you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for our Ciliary Report on Mind Control. Thank you for joining us. Have a wonderful day.